We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
The American Family Association's mission is to inform, equip, and activate individuals to strengthen the moral foundations of our culture. We also support the church. Our goal is to be a leading organization in biblical worldview training for cultural transformation. AFA aims to evangelize the lost and disciple the believer. We aim to strengthen biblical marriages and equip parents to raise godly children.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government.
I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it is Wednesday, November 13th, and a lot of news since we were together yesterday morning. It feels like at least 72 news cycles. There's so much to cover between the all-important Senate Majority Leader race that is happening today. We will get to that in a moment. Also, potentially a speaker showdown in the House where Mike Johnson's gavel appears to potentially be in peril. And also a flurry of Trump cabinet appointments and some interesting appointments there and other creation, especially the Department of Government Efficiency that Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy were appointed to. So we'll get to all of that here. But let's start with the Senate Majority Leader race. So this is happening today with a closed ballot in the Senate. And I think that it's fair for a lot of people to call for an open ballot so that senators are actually accountable for who they voted for. But we have to remember that even constitutionally, both the Senate and the House can choose its own officers. This isn't subject to public approval. It's not subject to a population vote. It's not, you know, subject to anything in terms of our opinions. And yet, because senators, like the House now, and representatives are popularly elected, it would seem like in terms of accountability, it would be fair to have this an open ballot. But for everything, at least that we know so far, like in previous years, this will be a secret ballot. And there are three individuals running. There are, of course, the two Johns, John Cornyn, a senator from the state of Texas, John Thune, senator from South Dakota, and more recently, as of just May, Rick Scott, a senator from Florida, who is in his second term. The other two are in their, I believe it's their fourth term, so a little bit more experience of the Johns. But Rick Scott kind of put his hat in the ring a little bit late in terms of that announcement, but it's just those three running. So a lot of people have, you know, emailed me, have posted on social media and said, well, you know, what about Rand Paul? What about Mike Lee? What about all of, you know, these other people who I agree would be great, would be phenomenal, but they, for whatever reason, are not running. And let's remember that internally to the Senate, it matters a little bit more in terms of the power, the quid pro quo, shall we say, of some of this, and also the ability to fundraise. That's a huge deal. That was also a huge deal for the Speaker of the House, and why a lot of people, you know, in the wake of the ouster of Kevin McCarthy, that was a problem initially for the GOP, and especially during that interim where there was no Speaker. So Mike Johnson, I think, has done a phenomenal job on that side of things, whether or not a challenge to his speakership will ultimately be successful. We will have to wait and see. That will probably at least kick off today. I know that at least Chip Roy, one of our good friends who's with us regularly, a representative from the state of Texas, is likely going to challenge Mike Johnson for the speakership. So was busy last night trying to determine some of those votes. So that's a really important race. But in terms of the Senate majority, this is a seat that has been since the early 2000s. Under McConnell, and he has been the Senate Majority Leader for, in my opinion, just way too long. So when he is finally retiring out of the Senate, this is an opportunity for new leadership. And this is why you're seeing a lot of people, AFA Action included, myself included, I've publicly said that I support Rick Scott. And the reason for that is because it seems to be a little bit more of the new blood and less of the establishment. Because, of course, John Thune, which some have called the Democrat pick, has been the minority leader under McConnell previously, and it has really just been kind of his second for a long time. And so people are, I think, rightly concerned that either of the two Johns would just be an extension and basically yet another term of a McConnell style of leadership. So where does Trump factor into all of this? Because, of course, with the trifecta and the Senate leadership, this is going to be very important to get Trump's agenda through Congress and fairly quickly. But with all of these appointments, some of which, and quite a few of which, require Senate confirmation, that's a really big deal. Because we remember in the first term of Trump, a lot of his appointments were held up just through Senate confirmation hearings, through, you know, other types of process games that both the left and even the GOP were playing in his first term. So while Trump has not openly endorsed any of the three candidates, he has said as recently as Sunday that he expects that the Senate will allow recess appointments so that he can kind of push through some of his nominees very quickly, and that they won't be held up in some of these kind of lengthy confirmation hearings. And in response to that, all three candidates pretty quickly agreed and said, you know, yeah, we will work with you to make sure that your nominees are confirmed. And so whether or not Trump kind of in his famous way sort of last minute endorses someone today, we will have to wait and see. But it appears to be, at least, that he is sitting out of that and allowing the Senate to kind of take care of its own business as long as any one of the three are willing to work with him. But Senator Mike Lee also posted kind of late last night that he hosted and moderated a forum for the GOP senators. And he said this on social media, giving my colleagues a chance to hear from each of the three candidates running to replace McConnell. After hearing from each candidate, I've decided to support Rick Scott. Here are my takeaways. As I've been saying for months, the Senate is supposed to be, quote, the world's greatest deliberative body, unquote, but it has ceased to function as such in recent years as majority leaders from both political parties have consolidated power at the expense of nearly every other senator. Senators are supposed to have ample opportunity to debate, discuss, and amend important legislation, and the Senate rules offer important procedural protections to ensure such outcomes. Those rules have been short-circuited by leaders of both parties. He also goes on to say the firm's vast power is good for the firm and its members, and for a handful of lobbyists and staffers who serve as its acolytes, but is bad for the Senate as a whole and especially bad for the American people. For that reason, I've been calling on those running to become the next Senate GOP leader to agree to a series of reforms designed to restore rules, customs, and practices that have passed that in the past helped earn the Senate the currently inaccurate title of the world's greatest deliberative body. And then he goes on to say, while I personally like all three of the leadership candidates and consider them friends, and while each offers a unique skill set of experience, you know, blah, 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 you know, footnote, 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 Rick Scott stands out as the most aggressively reform-minded. So this is interesting because, you know, Mike Lee, no youngin in the Senate himself, is basically saying, you know, we need somebody who is willing to go against the establishment and against the rules. And this is kind of the transformation overall that I think everyone in Washington who is at all paying attention, like Mike Lee and like the Trump appointees that have been nominated to these cabinet positions. And I think the obviously the popular vote of the American people are wanting change. The establishment, even of the GOP and especially of the elitist left, has been thoroughly rejected by the vote for Trump to come back in and by the very public support of Rick Scott and even those who are opposed to Mike Johnson for speaker, which, you know, as all of you who listen to this program regularly know, you know, I haven't agreed with Mike Johnson on everything that he's done as speaker. I think he's had a very difficult term coming in after McCarthy with such a narrow, incredibly narrow House majority, and his own conference can't decide on things, that if he lost even a couple members of his conference to voting with the Democrats, then that essentially cedes the entire majority. So I personally would like to see what Speaker Johnson can do with this kind of new reform that is coming in January. I think that he is definitely a stalwart conservative. His mentality, as we've talked about before, is to be more of a team leader and more of a shepherd of the will of the whole as the conference. He always says and has said to me personally, both publicly and privately, that, you know, Congress is a team sport. It's not just like the executive agency where you have one president who just dictates to everybody. He doesn't see the speaker's role in that way. But I hope that with a stronger majority, not only in the House, but also as a whole within Washington, he will be able to push through some of those conservative priorities that he really didn't have an opportunity to do. So, I mean, I know a lot of people, and myself included, are very frustrated at Ukraine funding, you know, a lot of this other stuff, but you have to deal with the hand that you are dealt. And so I have also personally, just in my own personal capacity, publicly supported Speaker Johnson for a second term as Speaker. I think he should be given that opportunity. I think he's a great person personally. But I also think that somebody like a Chip Roy would be fantastic. And so this is where, you know, kind of like we were in the GOP primary where for president, that, you know, we have a wide bench, and that's actually a very good thing. And so it's not a matter of, you know, picking your factions and then people still stay, you know, into their different groups and everything. It's been really remarkable to see a lot of people on social media that I think are more divisive minded, you know, to still call out people who supported, for example, DeSantis or Haley or, you know, anybody else in the GOP primary when DeSantis and Haley both endorsed and supported Trump. It's like this is the moment that we all come together, regardless of who we all supported or didn't in any of these positions, and say, listen, you know, now that there is actually an opportunity, we need to move forward as conservatives, not just as Republicans even. I mean, this isn't even about party, because I think that Trump is kind of smashing the image of what the Republicans have been under a Mitch McConnell, under a Paul Ryan, under an establishment, even more than he did in 2016, and really move forward. And this is why the best appointment, I think, coming out of last night was also about this Department of Government Efficiency. It's going to be very interesting to me to see, will this be an internal agency, or in my view, it's more likely and probably smarter, frankly, to be an external independent agency so that Elon and Vivek don't have to divest from, you know, SpaceX and Tesla and Vivek's corporations. But especially because if we are basically giving the hammer of Thor to Elon to go in and just completely dismantle the bureaucracy, which is what everybody voted for in the majority, not just the Electoral College, but also the popular vote, then he needs to not be subject to the very same bureaucracy that he is trying to absolutely crush. So I think that they're going to be strategic about this. And, you know, for Elon coming in and overhauling Twitter in just, you know, a matter of weeks and months, this is one agency I am really excited to see get off the ground. And I don't think that it's just going to be sort of this fiction like a lot of the leftists are hoping for and a lot of the mainstream media that's like, well, you know, this, we'll see if this ever comes to fruition. Oh, I think it will. I think that Elon and Vivek have been very personally appointed for this specific task. And I really do hope that in this next administration, we're going to see not only a willing House and Senate and their respective leaders that will be elected today work with a Trump administration with some really good appointments to say, we're going to get rid of some things like the Department of Education. We're going to get rid of all of these, you know, ridiculous out of control spending. We are going to dismantle some of the deep state bureaucracy and all of these federal employees that just persist through administration to administration and basically don't care what the directive is from the person actually in the Oval Office. I mean, I saw that when I worked for Trump, and I was external, which I understand completely, believe me, the advantages of being external while being able to work directly for the sitting president. I was external, so I didn't have any of those government restrictions, and that's exactly what Elon Musk probably wants, so that you can go in and dismantle. But I saw how much the deep state and the bureaucracy worked against Trump in his first term so that his priorities weren't accomplished. So we need to pray. We need to all collectively support this agenda, put aside any of the, you know, primary grievances, you know, whatever. That's all in the past. This is a new morning in America. I'm excited for it. And let's all pray that we can turn America around. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And so we're talking about this new day in America and the opportunity to really advance some conservative priorities that, you know, just a couple of weeks ago seemed like just a pipe dream potentially for conservatives and especially for Christians. And so what should be our priorities as we head into the new year and a second Trump administration, particularly some of the worldview aspects of conservatives that really are trying to conserve a government that is pro-liberty and is created in order to fulfill the institution of government that God himself ordained to promote good, restrain evil. So let's bring in Ryan Helfenbein, who is, of course, a friend of the show, and he is the executive director of the Standing for Freedom Center at Liberty University. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning, Jenna. Great to be on with you.
Yeah. So, you know, your thoughts overall is, as I'm sure like me, you have been ruminating over the last week of, you know, wow, this is actually happening in America, that we have this trifecta. Trump has this mandate. And we're seeing that, you know, the majority of American voters actually want this type of change, maybe back to a moral and upright society.
Yes, I think that it's a return to common sense. I think when you look at the vote, and you're considering why most Americans, I mean, Donald Trump did win not only the Electoral College, but he won the popular vote. I think a lot of it has to do with a kind of pragmatic ordering of things. While there are Americans that are concerned about religious values and true conservatism, there are others that are making a pragmatic decision between two choices. And they want, I think, a return to law and order, to civility. They can't afford the America they're living in. There are people that still have dreams and ambitions for themselves, for their family, for their future. They want to be able to afford the American promise. It came probably down to less about abortion and more about bacon and eggs. and the price of gasoline. When you think about the border policy and what's happening, immigrants are being given and treated better in our country by DHS, by FEMA, than our own citizens, than our own folks who are suffering as a result of the disaster from two major hurricanes. Not only that, but you think about the homelessness of veterans. The mental health crisis has claimed more lives of veterans than both wars in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So there's a lot to do in America, and I think this election shows that people are wanting to go back to common sense. Now, in terms of biblical worldview, in terms of a traditional understanding, framing of the Constitution and American freedom and all of that, I think we have a long way to go to win back the hearts and minds of most average Americans. While this was certainly a great outcome, there's a lot of work to do, Jenna, I think, to rebuilding America.
And that is such an important point to underscore. Ryan Helfenbein, my special guest this morning, the executive director of the Standing for Freedom Center at Liberty University. Because when you look even at the outcome, like here in the state of Florida, and I've been using this as an example since the election, the Amendment 4, which was this extreme abortion measure, thankfully failed in Florida, but it actually got over 50%. The only reason it failed is because of that 60% threshold, which means that even though there are 1 million more registered Republicans in the state of Florida, and we are a red state, very conservative, have obviously a very conservative great governor, that means that Republicans would have voted for this as well. So that necessarily, I think, means that even some self-identified Christians are saying, well, you know, maybe we can at least understand where abortion should be allowed, maybe up to 12 weeks or taking kind of, Trump's position saying, well, 6 weeks is too soon and we need to extend that, right? And that's, I think, where a big piece of the battleground is, because while conservatives and even the godless populace can agree on things like the economy, border safety, and those things have obviously intrinsic moral components. The things that are more kind of in our face, moral, like abortion regulation, being pro-life, and especially the LGBTQ agenda. I mean, we still have, Obergefell that is out there and still have, a lot of the trans nonsense that is going on. We still have a lot of work to do. I mean, even here in the state of Florida, to convince voters and even Republicans to do the most basic things that are moral and sound, like protect life.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. The life issue is still central. It's still fundamental. It's still a first priority among true conservatives and Christians. We were all cheering the fact that Amendment 4 was defeated. But it, as you point out rightly, it was defeated in Florida because it failed to reach a 60% majority. It did pass, I think it went as high as 56 or 57% of the vote in the state of Florida. So we have a lot of work to do, explaining why the life issue matters. Why a baby should not be punished, should not pay the ultimate price. The unborn have been paying the ultimate price for sins and indiscretions. And then just even the fact that there are women and men who find children, babies, not as blessings and gifts given by God, but as an inconvenience to be discarded. We have a lot of work to do. Even now in my Commonwealth of Virginia, there's a discussion right now about an amendment here to try and change the Constitution to enshrine abortion in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and they're trying to do that. So state by state, they're trying to make these gains. And so there's a lot we have to do to push back. We have to remember, and as you point out, Obergefell and Bostock, these are rulings the Supreme Court majority, by the way, 6-3. Came down on the Bostock decision, enshrining an aspect of the LGBTQ agenda in Title VII. These are the kinds of things that we have to look at. So we're trying to protect children, but we're also trying to advance religious liberty, and continue to win ground on these issues. So curriculum, the sexualization of children, the grooming that was going on in public schools, that didn't just stop because an election was won or election was lost. That work has to be done on the ground by American citizens, state by state by state. That's not something the White House is going to solve. That is for you and I and all of these citizens to roll up our sleeves and to take part in. So it's going to be an interesting time. It's certainly a better outcome than what could have been with a Harris-Walz administration. We now have an opportunity, Jenna, I think, to really make some gains.
Yeah, well said, Ryan, and I could not agree more. And you know, it's interesting to talk about all of this in the context of now moving forward in what is obviously a better situation than, as you just said, it could have been. And yet there's, you know, there is the counter argument in terms of revival of the church, which is absolutely necessary for a moral and upright society, that, you know, in times of prosperity and comfort and all of those things, it's less likely that the masses, you know, return to God when you see some of the unfortunate persecution. We never want persecution of Christians, but sometimes in times of trouble, that's where people turn to God. And so, you know, one of the potential silver linings of a Harris-Walz administration is that if, you know, Christians continue to be targeted and all of these things, that we may see at least the church be willing to stand up and fill the gap. But now in another Trump administration, one of the things that I am concerned about is how many people, especially younger people, and, you know, you're at Liberty University, so you're around, you know, the young college students all the time, how much the young people have had a replacement, really, of their faith and the church as an institution with government and politics. And we can't move forward into that type of godless populism.
Yeah, no. You can't have wokeness on the left, and you certainly can't have it on the right. And there is a danger. There's a real danger of a kind of conservatism that is Christless, a kind of conservatism that is really skiing behind the left, just going slower, you know. And that is something that we have to be on guard against. Certainly for the next generation, understanding what the fountain of freedom is, it's really Jesus Christ. It really is the gospel. You can't have any of this political stuff, ordered liberty and ultimately freedom under God, if you do not declare first and foremost your allegiance to God. And which God is it? That's the triune God, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Absolutely paramount that the church in this moment doesn't kick up its feet, doesn't sort of rest on its own sort of laurels. Though there's nothing really to be proud of in this moment, I would say, in terms of where we stand in American Christianity. We have to recognize that this is a time to repent. This is a time to return back to the gospel, to our first love. This is a time where the church does need to be mobilized. Just like that vote in Florida shows us, demonstrates on the life issue, the church has a lot of work to do. And it begins in the house of God. It really begins in the pew. You know, just talking about that issue on life itself, one out of four women in the church have had an abortion. This is something that pastors need to recognize. We have an epidemic all across this country that we have to address. So, people are breathing a little easier, as we all recognize this week, because of the kind of persecution that we were anticipating that would have inevitably come under the Harris-Walz administration. Now there's a different kind of testing for us. And so we have to be found faithful and not waste our opportunity to make real gains in this country.
Absolutely. And along those lines, I mean, to make those gains and ensure that we have the opportunity as Christians to be able to evangelize, to be able to speak the truth of the gospel of Christ in a way that is actually legally protected. And of course, in some nations, it's not. You're risking your very life at times to teach the things of God. Where here in America, we have so long benefited from the blessing blessings of liberty, to be able to speak together and publicly about the truth of God. This necessarily then becomes a conversation about religious freedom, about, you know, First Amendment protections. Where do you see the priorities moving forward in the next 4 years to ensure that things like, you know, the targeting of Christian families and individuals outside of abortion clinics or in their churches, or, you know, all of these things that we saw over the last 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration can't happen again?
You know, I think one of the things that we recognize going all the way back to 2017, 2018, 2019, these AstroTurf campaigns that exist on the left, we don't see them on the right, but we certainly see them on the left. They're massively funded to the tune of billions of dollars. BLM is a perfect example of this. There was over 30 cities in the United States where rioting, looting, billions of dollars in property destruction commenced over weeks and weeks and weeks, and police could do almost nothing. They tried their best, but in many cases, they were given stand down orders. They took to the streets. They burned things. We saw all of this. The media lied about what was happening in terms of the narrative being propagated. These AstroTurf campaigns are un-American. They're not trivial. They're certainly present a danger to society. The fact that people can commit lawlessness, acts of degeneracy, they can destroy property in the name of social protest. But it's really what it is it's funded by mega billion-dollar organizations. George Soros is one of them. It ought to be illegal, Jenna, to do that. And they're trying to social engineer. They're trying to advance their agenda under threat. And so law-abiding citizens, they have nothing to do but to stay home and to shelter in place. This should not happen in America. And I think there's something that needs to happen there, certainly on the front of religious liberty and education. Department of Ed is in a place where for decades they've been able to advance their agenda and the agenda of teachers' unions at the expense of education outcomes and at the expense of the health and safety of our children. They're advancing a different kind of agenda. In the most recent years, sexual orientation, gender identity, that became their primary focus. They cared less about reading, writing, and arithmetic. They cared more about what was going on in bathrooms and making sure that transgender identity movement was being represented in the classroom at the expense of everyone else. So there's huge things that need to happen there in order to push back on that. I certainly think that Christians, we have our work cut out for us, not only advancing the gospel, but also winning the public debate on why faith works, why faith is important, why faith leads to better social outcomes. It leads to better physical health, better mental health, spiritual health. All of those things matter. It leads to better outcomes in education. It leads to stronger men. It leads to stronger women. It leads to a more healthy and flourishing society. So I think there's a lot of things that we need to do in the United States right now in order to stand up and to advance the cause of liberty and freedom. But it really starts with the gospel of Jesus Christ, and it starts with revival.
Yeah. Amen and amen. Thank you so much, Ryan Helfenbein, for your comments. As usual, spot on. And this is why we need to, as Christians, be daily in the Word, knowing what is contained in our sword of the Spirit, so that we can then go out and make sure that we are living effectively as Christians, living in truth, and effectively being part of our civil society and affecting our civil society for the good, and to continue to promote religious liberty. So we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So, you know, we do really have an opportunity to reshape this country, even in the next 4 years. And it's very interesting to see how a lot of the left are kind of pushing back against this notion and saying, you know, what about process? What about the rule of law? And oh no, you know, this is a threat to democracy, like all of these kinds of things, when they were literally running on the notion that they wanted to transform America in so many different ways, not the least of which is, you know, all of the open borders and, you know, some of those policies, because policies really do affect the culture and the day-to-day of American life. And this is why the civil government aspect is so important for Christians to be engaged in and understand. But as we mentioned in the last segment with Ryan Helfenbein, and I just want to underscore that again, you know, Christians can't be so entirely focused on politics and government that we forget that our first and primary roles are to be within our family and then, of course, members of the church. Because if our families were doing what we are called to do and churches were doing what they are called to do, then necessarily politics in this country would not be nearly as important. And, you know, I love what now Congressman Kevin Kiley actually once said while he was running during the whole recall of Gavin Newsom. Remember that, you know, so many news cycles ago that unfortunately was not successful in California. But, you know, he ran on this platform that I thought was really brilliantly stated, where he said, you know, government should be run so effectively to protect liberty and freedom that we as Americans don't even need to remember that it's even there. You know, we don't need to be so concerned every morning getting up on all of our devices and going, you know, what happened today and what is going to, you know, be the outcome, and having these massive, you know, swings back and forth from administration to administration. And this is why hopefully some legislation through Congress will be a lot more long-term effective than just executive actions and some of these things. But I hope that as an entire society, in the next 4 years, we can take this as an opportunity to really reshape how Christians think of government. So for regular listeners, you all know that I've been teaching this class at my church on Wednesday night. So we have this class coming up tonight, and we're going through my book, The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution, and going through, you know, the framework of American government originally. And it was surprising, you know, to a lot of the people who come to this class and people who read my book and, you know, have heard me lecture on this for years now. The book is 10 years old. I can't even believe it. That the American system of government is not necessarily per se the best form. Now, we can argue for good processes. We can argue that, you know, it is a good thing that we can amend the Constitution, our highest law of the land. But it's also then not been beneficial in some of these ways, like looking at the Senate majority leader vote today. The only reason that this has become the composition of the Senate that we currently have is because of the 17th Amendment, where we popularly elect senators. If we actually went back to the original understanding of our entire system of government, that was a much better way to do things. And we've gotten off track, but that wasn't necessarily the only best way to do things. We can amend the Constitution to make things even better, but we have to, of course, be careful with it. But all of that necessarily means that we don't look at America and our system totally in isolation of other systems and especially world history. I mean, our founders came from a long legacy and history and tradition and understanding of divine law that is shaped by God himself, that he is the authority, that institutions are created by God for our good, and the institutions of government are civil government, the church government, the family government, and that God ordains and establishes for our good how those systems are to function to best serve us individually and also living collectively in a society. Truth in community is our definition of civil society and politics, but even necessarily living within a family and also being able to be the best Christians that we can individually, understanding our responsibilities. And God did not set up and dictate to us by his authority, which he could have, absolutely he could have. He didn't dictate everything. He established the structure of each of these institutions with some absolute parameters. And this is where we get to the theology of the definition of a family. I mean, I've been researching for another project that I have with AFA Action, this Massachusetts parentage law. And, you know, this is kind of this, it hasn't gotten a lot of media attention, but basically what the left is trying to do is to completely reinvent what it means to be a family and what it means to have parentage. And they're taking this from a natural right that is God-given, God-ordained, God-established, God-defined, and taking it and wanting to create this as a civil right and basically a privilege that government can say, well, you're entitled to this, and it is a quote-unquote human right, and it is a civil right if you simply want to have a child and become and assent to this kind of redefinition of what parentage means. And so this then, under their view, necessarily means that the government has to protect even the homosexual couple, the throuple, the single parent, the, you know, whoever. It doesn't matter, as long as it is an adult or number of adults that choose by whatever method of, you know, now that we have a lot more scientific methods, to have a child or to adopt a child or to come into basically possession of a child is how this law is going. And that absolutely conflicts 100% with the design that God instituted for the family. Now, families do look different in terms of some of their internal rulemaking structures, in terms of even their composition. I mean, some people have no kids, some people have 10 kids, and everywhere in between, and even more than that, right? But those things are not proscribed and necessarily defined by God. He doesn't say the only way that you can be a competent, God-honoring family is if you have 3 kids, right? God doesn't say that. And yet, he does prescribe that a family and a marriage specifically has to be between one man and one woman. That's a non-negotiable. And so what we see is within the system and the government organization and definition of a family, God has set up certain parameters, and within those boundaries, within those guardrails, then there is some flexibility. And there is some wisdom. I mean, it may be a wisdom issue why people have more or fewer children. It may be a biological reality. I mean, all kinds of different reasons, as long as those reasons are God-honoring. And it's the same thing with the church design. And this is actually a topic that my home church in Colorado, and I still call it my home church because I visit every time I'm in Colorado. I love it. I still love my pastor there and talk with him frequently. They talk about this all the time, about the structure of a church and how, you know, in the New Testament and the New Testament church, God prescribed a structure, and we get church leadership and the requirements for church leadership and who we would call elders and who we'd call deacons or overseers, and what those specific parameters must be. And this is where we get to the theological conclusion that God himself prescribed that men have to fill the role of the ecclesia. Women absolutely can serve all of our gifts. I teach sometimes in the Sunday school there, even when I visit, and, you know, and teach about the civil government or, you know, a wide variety of things. My mom teaches a theology class there, because that's something that she is very well versed in and actually has her master's degree in. And so to go through systematic theology, and actually a lot of you who are listening have gone through that class. So the whole idea of our system of government has to be necessarily understood that God dictates certain parameters, and we as a country and a nation, if we want to honor him, abide by those parameters in family, church, and civil government. But then within that, we have freedom to walk in the wisdom of God. And I'm being told that our guest, Representative Andy Biggs from the great state of Arizona, is ready. So speaking about processes and the wisdom, this is going to be, you know, very interesting next at least 2 years. But good morning, Representative Biggs. And I'm very interested in the potential speaker race. How is that shaping up as the House selects its leader?
Yeah, Jenna, thanks. And sorry to be late. They're going to try to do Speaker Johnson by a vote of acclamation, which I think is anathema to a lot of people that maybe you should have a discussion about it. So I think you're going to see that discussion take place. Does Johnson have the vast majority of the conference? Yeah, I think he does. But I think that there has to be a discussion because you can't have somebody who is not going to advance the agenda that we all just ran on and the American people gave a mandate for.
So this vote of acclamation, how would that differ from the traditional way of selecting a leader, like what we just saw when Speaker Johnson was elected?
Well, vote of acclamation is just the chair of the conference. You know, it's like nobody else is running, so let's do a vote of acclamation. And so they do a voice vote. And even if somebody stands up and says, well, no, I don't want to give a vote of acclamation, they just override that because the vast majority will have just voted voice vote. And really what needs to happen is you need to have either a secret ballot or a paper ballot so where everybody can voice their opinion so you can just adjudicate where he is with the conference. You know, maybe he has 30 people that are struggling to get there and want to get assurances from him, want to make sure that we're going to make the process for the policies, because you got it right. The process determines how you're going to get the policies through, and good process leads to the good policies. And I think that's the issue that people have. Yeah, so that's the difference. You either stand up and it gets rammed through, or you actually have a vote that says, well, he doesn't have unanimity. Let's figure out what needs to be done to ensure that unity that needs to take place.
And we're hearing, and that's absolutely true, and we're hearing, Representative Biggs, that Chip Roy from Texas may vie for that speakership. Would that necessarily mean then that vote of acclamation couldn't take place and it would have to go to that traditional vote if he has a challenger?
Yeah, so what would happen is if you have a challenger, then you go to a traditional format where there's debate, there's the votes and until everybody feels comfortable. There's another way to do it, though. I mean, the rules itself allow for someone to stand up and say, look, I want a ballot, an actual ballot on it. And if enough people stand up and say, yeah, we agree with that, then you have a ballot, and then you can, again, judge whether it's unanimous or whether there's some holes, and then you get to decide, do we want to work it out now or do you want to have a messy fight in January? Seems to me you'd want to know that stuff now, resolve that stuff now, and then make sure that we have the structure in place to deliver on the mandate that the American people just gave us.
Absolutely. And in just the last minute or so that we have with you, Representative Andy Biggs, and I appreciate you dropping by this morning, are you supporting a challenger or Speaker Johnson, or, you know, where are you personally at, and where do you think the rest of the conference is at?
Well, personally, I do think that Mike Johnson may end up and will likely end up being the speaker. I'm personally, you know, I don't know that you need to have somebody run against him. I think you need to have that discussion if he can stand up and have a ballot, a separate ballot that's delivered, and you can see whether, you know, you got 10 people that have questions, you got 30 or 40 people, and then get to the bottom. That's where I am. For instance, so we've got the rules. We're going to discuss rules this week, which is as important as who your leader is, and that's
absolutely
what we've got to do as well.
Well, we will be very interested to see how that goes. We are already out of time, and so thank you. We'll have to have you back on again for a longer segment. But for all of those listening, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. We'll be back tomorrow with probably another 72 new cycles that will have passed in the interim. Have a great day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.